Captain.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started with the Senate Committee on Judiciary. So we're open our meeting. We have a number of public hearings and possible work sessions. What we're going to do is, first of all, I just need to make an announcement, an apology. I have a bill up that's at 8:15. Vice Chair Boquist will take over for the public hearings. What we're planning on doing is this morning we'll do the public hearings, then we will come back for those that are ready, and we have the votes to move forward today with the work sessions after I return from my other committee where the other bill's at. So with that, we're going to open up the first public hearing, which is House Bill 2641A. And counsel?
2641A modifies the definition of online communication for purposes of online sexual corruption of a child to include telephone text messages, broadens the definition of online communication to cover current technological advances, no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact.
Good morning, Andy.
Good morning.
I'm going to go ahead and ask Brad Berry to come on up and join us, and you can go ahead and get started.
My name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative out of the Albany area. Almost was about ready to say the Albany Patrol Office, but that's been a while back. So, anyways, thank you for listening to this morning. This bill amends House Bill 2641, sexting, amends ORS 163.431 and 163.433, first and second degree online sexual corruption. During the 2007, House Bill 3515 was passed by the legislature to protect children from predatory advances through the Internet. With the advent of new technology comes additional challenges. In an effort to protect our children from sexual predators, House Bill 2641 addresses the issue of new technology by including all methods of transmission a predator may use: wire, radio, optical cable, cellular system, electromagnetic system, or other similar means. For example, last year, as a result of an incident involving a high school teacher and a female student, a principal asked if texting messages were sent and asked if texting messages and photos could be added to the mentioned statutes. The local law enforcement agency was unable to take enforcement action due to the fact there was no crime, and the teacher was eventually removed as a result of administrative issues. What I wanted to share with you here real quick, Mr. Chair and committee members, is last November when I was down in Orlando, Florida, they had three articles in their paper that dealt with the issue, the relationship between students and teachers. And I'm not focusing specifically at teachers here, but it was interesting that the majority of the teachers that were being charged with sex crimes started out texting messages. So the state of Florida has pursued this as an issue as well. House Bill 2641 addresses a fast-growing communications problem, sexting, the use of sending messages, photos via the cell phone, or any other means. This bill makes ORS 163.431 and 433 stronger. Again, in the effort to protect our children, this bill passed the House for 59-1 vote. I urge you to strongly consider moving this bill forward to the Senate floor. Thank you.
Brad?
Thank you. Chair Prezanski and members of the committee, my name is Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney, and I chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. We are strongly in support of Representative Olson and the other sponsors of this bill. We are strongly in support of this bill. We see it actually as a little more simple than that, as merely attempting to fix what are loopholes based on new technology. As you recall, the 2007 session dealt with several bills trying to get at the predatory conduct online via the Internet, soliciting children for sex, and really the legislature is to be commended for the hard work and on those bills. But what really happens is things change. We need to move forward to make sure that we're covering the types of behavior that then occur. I can tell you anecdotally from my county, we have had predators who began solicitation online through things like Facebook and the like, and continue those solicitation by text messaging through telephones. Just this week, I had a woman come into my office asking what, if anything, could be done when her daughter received pictures of a young man's genitalia via a cell phone after they had casually met at some event. I don't remember the exact particulars now. This bill would really get at what is becoming very common behavior and appears to be a loophole in what was otherwise the intent before of being able to deal with these sexual predators.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on House Bill 2641A? Not seeing anyone, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2641A. Since I'm here, we'll go ahead and entertain motions in a work session.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist moves the adoption of the A2 amendment into House Bill 2641. And regarding the A2, if you just want to give us, counsel, just a quick overview so everyone knows what that is.
The A2 amendment simply corrects an error that's in the engrossed bill, which says that essentially once the bill goes into effect, it applies to text messages. This actually applies to all communications that are listed in the bill, so it simply changes that language to make sure that upon the effective date, the bill applies to all communications through cellular phones, et cetera.
All right, and this was Representative Olson was talking about expanding it to make certain that it was basically keeping up with the times and not just texting, since we don't know what else in the communication world we'll have.
Correct.
All right. Any discussion on the adoption of that amendment? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, move 2641 as adopted with the A2 with due class.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2641A as amended by the dash two amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Anyone want to volunteer on this one?
Okay.
All right, Senator Wissett will be the carrier on 2641A. And we'll close the work session on that one. We'll go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which is House Bill 2331.
House Bill 2331A prevents a person who has previously entered a diversion program from being eligible for diversion on subsequent offense. Allows person to enter, the engrossed version allows a person to enter diversion if 15 years have passed since the person's last diversion and if they've not been convicted of any crime during that period of time. The committee members have proposed A3 amendments in front of them, which would eliminate the language referring to would actually tighten up the language referring to prior convictions and provide that you could have a second diversion if in the preceding 15 years you had not been convicted of a crime involving a motor vehicle.
Thank you, Councilor Gale. 2331A, right?
Mm-hmm.
We only have one person signed up. You're it.
Is there an amendment? Could you repeat your amendment? I'm sorry.
The engrossed version said essentially that you could not have a second diversion if within 15 years preceding you had been convicted of any crime, essentially.
Yes.
The A3 amendment simply says that if you've been convicted of a crime involving a motor vehicle, then you would be prevented from having the second or subsequent diversion.
Go ahead, Gail.
Thank you. Mr. Boquist, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. With the dash A3s, we would be neutral, if that's what the committee is intending to work.
I don't know what the committee is intending to work, because I'm not the chair.
Okay. As to the engrossed version of the bill, we would register an objection because there is an access between the intervening criminal conviction and the use of a motor vehicle. We think that there should be a nexus. It's counterintuitive, perhaps, but it does promote public safety to allow people to enter diversion because DUII cases are the most triable cases. There is a high incidence of acquittal in these matters, and it actually does promote public safety if you make people diversion eligible. So we would be neutral on the A3s.
Anything else you'd like to add for the record? Thank you. I'd like to ask Brad Berry to come up, if he would, please.
Well, see, I was kind of thinking, you know, maybe this is like one of those legal things, you know, they come in at the last minute or something.
Senator, Vice Chair Boquist, and members of the committee, for the record, I am Brad Berry, Yamhill County District Attorney, District Attorney's Association Legislative Committee. Thank you for allowing me to come up. I signed up for several things this morning and omitted signing that particular form, so I apologize for the confusion. Senate Bill 2331 is a Oregon District Attorney's bill. This bill originally started with the notion of allowing a diversion once in a lifetime. After discussions on the other end of the building, it was modified to once every 15 years, along with the other caveat that you get a second diversion only if you haven't had other criminal convictions. Senator Prozanski was kind enough to discuss this bill with me yesterday or the day before and had the desire to limit those other convictions to other traffic-related convictions. We're okay with that limitation and the like. The principal thing here being that we recognize the diversion is there to recognize that people who otherwise wouldn't commit crimes, in fact, do get arrested for DUII, and that's why the diversion statutes are there. It doesn't lessen the conduct or lessen the danger that these people pose on the highways, but the system really does recognize that this can happen occasionally to people who otherwise would not commit crimes and allows them the diversion. This would limit diversions further by extending the current law for allowing it every 10 years to every 15 years. And I will tell you that within about a week or two of my testimony over on the House side of this, I had two different individuals arrested for DUII who were diversion eligible. One was 10 years and months, the other 11 years since their last DUI, and both of them had three prior convictions for driving under the influence, but now had spent 10 years without getting arrested for a DUI, and they were diversion eligible. So there is some frustration. We recognize those individuals pose a grave danger to the public safety, but that's what the law provided for. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Senator Boquist.
A3.
You just reiterate, since the chair just walked in, your position on the A3 amendment.
But as I mentioned, Chair Prozanski and Senator Boquist, members of the committee, Senator Prozanski did mention that to me the other day, that he wanted to limit these other crimes prohibiting eligibility for DUI diversion to other traffic crimes, and we're fine with that.
And, Mr. Chair, for the record, in the previous testimony, Gail Myers was neutral on the
A3.
Okay, great. On the bill with the A3.
Right.
All right. Any other questions for Brad? Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2331? And if not, we'll close the public hearing on 2331, and we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2331.
Mr. Chair, move the A3 into the main bill.
Okay. Senator Boquist moves the adoption of the A3s into House Bill 2331. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Chair, move 2331 with the A3s as amended to the floor with the due pass.
All right. Just for the record, Council has mentioned to me that we may not have all our paperwork. And so at this point,
I'm going to change the fiscal this amendment.
I don't think it is, but at the same time, my understanding is we don't have both unless the committee wants to suspend the rules and move forward. But
that's
Mr. Chair, I'd like to continue with the motion.
All right. Senator Boquist first moves that we suspend the rules that we're operating under to allow the bill to move forward at this point. Is there any objection? All right. And with that, the next motion Senator Boquist has made is that we move the bill, House Bill 2331, as amended by the A3s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, we're tightening this up, so it's going to get a narrow, any fiscal or anything else is going to get smaller, not larger.
That's correct. By limiting this to the secondary, it's going to be a minimal, because we are narrowing it from any and all crimes down to those that involve the operation of motor vehicles, so I agree it should be whatever would be less.
I'm not sure if the graduate public schools, I know zero and zero are still zero, so.
Any other comments? Any objection? So ordered, and the chair will carry this bill to the floor. And we'll close the public hearing on 2331A. And we'll open up our next public hearing. That was work session I closed. And we're opening up a public hearing on House Bill 2870A.
Yeah.
House Bill 2878 adds aggravated vehicular homicide, criminally negligent homicide with a vehicle, and manslaughter in the first and second degree involving a motor vehicle to the list of convictions requiring a permanent driver's license revocation. Provides that the revocation does not take effect until the offenders are released from prison and the charge for which the license was revoked. Increases the duration of a Department of Motor Vehicles DMV license revocation in certain circumstances to 10 years, consistent with the duration of a permanent license revocation ordered by a court. Has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, and we have all our paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and have a public hearing. I'll call up Ann Pratt, Doug Harklow, and Steve Dole. Whoever wants to get started.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Dole, Crime Victims United of Oregon. In 1993, the state of the law in Oregon was that if you killed someone while driving or severely injured someone while driving, your driver's license was revoked at the time of your conviction. So 5 years, and that revocation was for 5 years, so 5 years after the conviction, you could reapply for your license. Many times, people were sitting in prison and able to reapply for their licenses. The legislature in 1993 changed the law and said that the revocation would start at the time of release from prison and would go for 8 years from that time of release. So this has been in the law since 1993. House Bill 2870 basically brings some changes to that statute. The first change is the fact that since 1993, we've put in the statutes that for your third felony DUI conviction, or excuse me, for your fourth felony DUI conviction within 10 years, or for your third misdemeanor conviction in a lifetime, you receive a 10-year revocation. So it didn't make any sense anymore to have a 8-year revocation for people who killed with their automobile or maimed someone with their automobile, and had a 10-year revocation for those who had four felony DUIs or three misdemeanor DUIs. So this bill brings the 8-year revocation in line with the 10-year revocation. The second thing it did is we still have a bit of a problem with some cases where the clock starts ticking. And in some cases, we had people, instead of receiving a full 8-year revocation, they were receiving 6.5-year revocations or 7-year revocations because the clock was starting to tick because of the language in the statute while they were still in prison. And Ann Pratt will fill you in on that. But this is basically a housekeeping bill, and we thank you very much for giving it a hearing.
Good morning, Chair Posansky and members of the committee. My name is Ann Pratt. I'm a member of Crime Victims United, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and the Governor's Advisory Council on DUII. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2870. House Bill 2870 is asking for lifetime revocations for those who kill via motor vehicle, to include aggravated vehicular homicide, man one, man two, criminally negligent homicide, plus assault and murder when a motor vehicle is used intentionally as a deadly weapon. What it really means is that these offenders would receive a lifetime revocation with the opportunity to petition the court after 10 years to have their license reinstated. It would be only 2 more years than the current 8-year required revocation. A judge would then consider the nature of the offense, the degree of violence, the criminal behavior before and after the crime, and all relevant factors before granting the reinstatement. In other words, if they follow the law, they could get their license back. I believe House Bill 2870 would create that incentive. Lifetime revocations are for our very worst offenders, which currently includes those convicted of felony DUI and third misdemeanor DUIs. So why wouldn't those who kill via motor vehicle be considered in that category of Oregon's worst offenders? Most of these offenders who commit these crimes are driving while intoxicated. In addressing 809-409, in 1999 at sentencing, I was assured that my offender would receive an 8-year revocation, Oregon driver's license revocation, for the crime of killing my son via motor vehicle, to begin after he was released from incarceration. I was aware of the law because at the same time I was sitting in a courtroom, Steve Dole was lobbying the legislature to change language in 809-409 to ensure that these offenders would not begin their revocations while still incarcerated. I was as grateful as I could be and relieved at the time. But still, my offender's revocation began while he was still incarcerated, in spite of the intent of the law. These battles are hard for crime victims. They automatically propel you backward in time, and I thought about just letting it go. But I believed if this could happen in our case, it had very likely been happening and will continue to. And I didn't want other victims to feel the same helpless frustration. So I gathered my documents and contacted DMV again at the 1st of May last year. DMV consulted their legal advisors and did the research I requested with the information I provided at great length. I do want to express my appreciation again to DMV for their attention regarding this issue. But to make a long story short, DMV's legal advisors interpreted the language in 809-409 differently than interpreted by the legislature. And my offender began his revocation in May of last year, 6 months short, but he began his revocation 6 months before his release from incarceration for his consecutive sentence. When Senate Bill 1207 was passed, it was the intent of the legislature for this not to continue to happen, but we're here today again to fix this problem. The language in 809-409 needs to be corrected and the loophole closed so we don't have offenders who are sitting sentenced to revocated crimes and other crimes in the same episode being allowed to begin their revocation while still serving time. 809-409 states, a person whose driving privileges are revoked under this subsection may apply for a reinstatement of driving privileges if the sentence for the offense includes incarceration. The time this is 8 years from the date the person is released for the offense. For the offense, in our case, meant criminally negligent homicide, but the DUI part of the crime was not counted in the incarceration, even though it was in the same criminal episode and was ordered and served consecutively. For the offense needs to be changed to for the crime for which the person's driving privileges were revoked and any other crimes arising out of the same episode, whether it's an 8-year revocation or a lifetime revocation. It needs to be absolutely accurate as to when the revocation begins and ends. Mothers Against Drunk Driving, ODAA, and Brad Berry is here, but in the interest of time, is not up here to testify, but is more than willing to answer questions. The Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI, Chiefs, and the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance support House Bill 2870, along with Crime Victims United. Please vote yes on House Bill 2870. Thank you for this time.
Thank you. Doug? Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney, and I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. The Alliance is in support of this bill. I participated in the drafting of this, trying to get these technical changes as perfect as we possibly could so that we don't come back again. And Ms. Pratt and Mr. Dole have adequately explained this measure, but to summarize quickly, current law is murder and manslaughter, a lifetime suspension if you find that the defendant use the vehicle intentionally to do those. This switches it, and now it's only murder where the vehicle is used intentionally, but then it adds a whole series of very serious crimes where people die if it's as the result of an automobile accident. It's not really an accident, but they're using a car. And so we've added some crimes there. They're the most serious crimes. It makes it consistent with the DUI suspensions. And the truth of the matter, it's not lifetime. You can apply for after 10 years if you've done all the proper steps. So it's a good bill. I urge you to pass it. That's all I have.
Question.
Thank you, Senator Boquist.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm just a little baffled about how they could have interpreted what I see as the existing statute to allow the time to start while somebody's still incarcerated, because it seems to say if the sentence includes incarceration 8 years from the date the person is released from incarceration. So is there an explanation for that? Am I missing something?
Vice Chair Boquist, Senator Bonamici, the magic words are for the offense. For the offense that causes the revocation, that they are revocated for, which in our case was criminally negligent homicide. So the fact that the other crimes, and in our case it was the DUI, was to be served after that, they did not count that. So their revocation started when they completed serving their time for criminally negligent homicide.
Vice Chair Boquist, may I comment?
Yes.
Senator Bonamici and members of the committee, people get sent to prison for obviously more than one crime.
Right.
So he's in for two crimes. He does his criminally negligent homicide sentence first, and then they do the consecutive sentence thereafter. Well, the way the statute was interpreted by DMV was when you're done doing the one offense, criminally negligent homicide in Ms. Pratt's case, then you can go ahead and get a driver's license, even though you're still incarcerated on the next sentence, or on the the next sentence. And so that's why we wrote the language to cover all the crimes.
Thank you.
You're sentenced for at the same time.
I appreciate the explanation. I was trying to read between the lines, so thank you.
Further questions?
I've got a couple of questions. I'd like to go back to the main bill, and Ms. Pratt and I spent about 30 minutes talking about this. I'm very supportive of the bill, and I actually wish the chair was here. But, you know, there's so much fear about drunk driving now. I'm not sure more fear and more punishment is working. The original bill required the use of ignition locks. Could the three of you comment on there? I mean, I've been told that DMV says it's too expensive. There's members of this committee that have routinely said there needs to be a connection between the crime and the offense and what it is. And if you have a drunk driver, I'm at a loss of why we can't force them to do this and force them to pay their way as a connection to it. But I understand DMV has consistently said, for whatever reason, it's too expensive. Could the three of you comment on why we don't put locks, ignition locks, on these?
Vice Chair Boquist, it was in the original bill, and we would have really liked to have incorporated it and kept it, but I believe the verbal fiscal on that was somewhere around $90,000 since to implement the programming. And so we were forced to amend it out.
Counselors?
Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, when I was district attorney in Lane County, we started a program where we would ask the court to order ignition interlock. And it's actually running down there, and it's running pretty well. Periodically, Ms. Pratt and I get the statistics on that, and the defendants pay for it. It's a good program. We're all for it. We just couldn't make this bill go if we had it in there.
Chair comment?
In another legislative session, I think we could have this, but it was a fiscal issue.
It's my understanding that the fiscal was around $90,000. Could either any of your organization comment on about how many drunk drivers would fall under this category? I mean, if we had a $90,000 fiscal that was going to cost the state to implement this, approximately how many violations do we have a year that this could be divided upon?
I don't know, Chair Boquist or Vice Chair Boquist. I'm sorry.
Right. Go ahead, Senator Bonamici.
Mr. Harkleroad, how is that program working? You said it's working in Lane County, and the defendants are paying for the ignition interlock, correct?
Yes, that's correct. The law does allow for the court to order it in individual cases. It's just not a mass processing event that automatically happens. And so we just decided that we were going to figure out the program. Ms. Pratt helped with it, and the Mothers Against Drunk Driving figured out the program, got the you have to have a service provider attach the unit to the car, And there's a cost for that, and the court just orders it. And they don't order it in every case. They review each case as it comes through. And we normally ask for it if the intoxilizer result was 0.15 or greater. Judges usually order it most of the time when we ask for it.
And this isn't statewide? Can I follow questions? And this isn't statewide. It's county by county.
That's correct.
It's the court decides.
Other counties can do it, and I believe other counties do. Ms. Pratt, I think, knows more than that than I about that.
Senator Dingfelder, Vice Chair Boquist, I did get some information from other counties, and that is one of the criteria that most of them use to implement the ignition interlock. And I did get feedback from, I think it was about 8 other counties that said they were using the ignition interlock even on diversions.
Any other questions?
No, Vice Chair, we did have a bill in 2007 on ignition interlocks, and the testimony was very persuasive that they prevent further crimes. So I would be highly supportive of increasing their use if we could find a way to do so.
I would agree with that. Just one final question, and the counselor might have an answer to this, because we don't know what the fiscal was, and there's approximately $90,000. But I believe in other legislation, you've put forth a number of what 1 year of incarceration is for one individual in the state of Oregon. Do you recall vaguely what that number is?
I do recall vaguely what that number is, Vice Chair Boquist. It's about $26,000, I believe. I just looked at a fiscal that on a good bill for eluding that Senate Bill 245, which has a fiscal on it that put it in Ways and Means. You folks passed it out. And the fiscal for 1 year for one individual for 2 years was, I believe, 52 or 56,000.
So then, roughly, we're adding 8 to 10 years here. For a 2 year period, the cost of two individuals to be incarcerated would pay for the cost of the interlock system in the state of Oregon for our application at DMV, roughly.
Roughly right to me.
Thank you, Boquist. Any further questions?
I think the average cost of incarceration in the Department of Corrections is $78 a night right now.
Yeah.
So it's about $28,000.
Right. Thank you. Do we have anybody else? Is there anybody else who'd like to testify on 2870? Not? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to close the hearing on 2870 and open a hearing on 2339A.
House Bill 2339A expands information exempt from public disclosure to include certain personal information of public safety officers, district attorneys, deputy district attorneys, attorney general, and assistant attorney generals. Allows for disclosure of records to financial institutions and title companies for business purposes. The A3 amendments that are in front of the committee add city attorneys and deputy city attorneys to the bill. There's no revenue impact. There was a fiscal statement that was issued with an impact to the counties, and I believe the senators have that in front of them.
Thank you. And we have 5 people signed up, Brad Berry and Doug Harkalik. I see that's the 4 list, and then we'll move to the other list afterwards. Vice Chair Boquist and members of the committee, my name is Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney, and I chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. House Bill 2339 is a bill forwarded to you by the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and the principal portion of this bill restricts the disclosure of personal information of deputy district attorneys, primarily assistant attorneys general, DAs, and the like, that request that information be maintained confidentially. Deputy district attorneys day-to-day deal with folks who have made mistakes and come before the court. Day-to-day, they also deal with society's most dangerous and violent offenders. Some of these offenders turn their anger towards deputy district attorneys and the person who is seeking to keep them out of the community and to keep the rest of the community safe. Threats to deputy district attorneys are not uncommon. In every courthouse in the state, a person seeking to find a deputy district attorney can walk to a county clerk's office or to an assessor's office and with the click of a mouse
can locate the home address of a deputy district attorney. These folks can literally walk from the courtroom to an office in the building and look at public records, which will disclose the address of the deputy district attorney who just held them accountable for their conduct. This bill would prevent that. I'm not dealing in hypothetical situations as I talk about this, or the fear of threats. And if you allow me just a couple of moments to share some instances with you that have occurred in the not very distant past. First, I would, and I'm going to omit some of the, there is some very graphic sexual content in these letters that I'm going to share portions of with you, and I will omit those. But these are letters from offenders that have been written to deputy district attorneys, and in part, I will quote from them. First, and excuse the grammar, and some of these are hard for me to read because they're not written very well, but let me read some of these to you. I'm going to do a bit of time, but I won't be in forever. Remember that when I get out of prison, I will find you and put a bullet in your head. And little, and I'll leave the DDA's name out, will be no more. I swear in the name of Almighty God Allah, who sees the evil deed you did to his servant yesterday, I will get you. Another letter. You are doomed for eternity. I will make sure you die after my release from prison. Your husband, he will die soon, within the next couple months. I'm going to handle that myself. I will appear in a dream to him, but I will do it myself. Another one. Let me get to the nitty-gritty. You have good intuition because somebody on the outworld where you at take your life like you took mine, except I'll live and you are dead woman walking. I will be having someone pay you a visit at your house, and I might wait, or I might wait till I get out and do it myself. If I don't, you will be dead in a month. I was thinking about you today. I was thinking about you, your family, and your family's addresses, and the places you like to hang out. I'm hoping to pay you guys a visit soon. So tell me, have one of your clients ever wanted to kill you? Well, I'm not even one of your clients, and I would like to see you dead, grave dead. How would you like that, within the DDA's name, laying lifeless while someone rapes you and chokes you sometime? And then it goes on to call her names. This one actually is kind of interesting. You can see, I'll just hold up this piece of paper. It's written in the form of a court pleading, and says, the attached letter with it says, you have been found guilty in my court beyond a reasonable doubt by a jury, and I hereby sentence you to death by mutilation and cannibalism, and it goes on. We all are subject to threats from time to time. I will tell you personally, as an elected official, I had my phone was published. I didn't have a problem with that until one night when my wife and I were away from home and somebody called, got my phone number, called my house and threatened my stepdaughter. And we have had a deputy district attorney in Crook County whose life was threatened and an offender convicted of attempted murder on him. More recently, there's a case out of Lane County, and again, I will leave out the deputy DA's name, who, after handling this particular case, the offender then put into plan or put into motion a plan to set the deputy district attorney's home on fire and to kill he, his children, and his wife as they exited the house. That plan wasn't just hypothetical. He has been convicted of attempted aggravated murder on that case, and in fact had gone far enough to move along with that plan. But what is chilling to know about that case is he had actually the address of the deputy DA in his possession, or I'm sorry, the executed search warrant, it was in his house, had the address of the deputy DA, and that information was obtained from the assessor's computer in the courthouse, the same courthouse that he was convicted of his crimes by the deputy DA, who he then threatened. The Stan Butterfield is here, is still here, and advised me just a few minutes ago, one of his deputy DAs received a threat, and in fact the threat was serious enough that for 3 weeks police were required to escort her children to and from school. This is not we're not being paranoid. These are very real things. What this bill seeks to do is to see that public records at the request of a DDA are made confidential for the purposes of personal identifying information, particularly name, address, phone number, email, such that it is not so easy for these offenders to locate deputy district attorneys and to do them harm. The bill was modified on the House side to address the concerns of financial institutions who are in very short time frames for getting information for the purposes of loans, for example, and title searches, but otherwise remained relatively unchanged. And it was passed by the House, if I recall correctly, unanimously. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Doug.
Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee. My name is Doug Harkelrode. I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance for the record, and I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney. The case that Mr. Berry excellently summarized about the lawyer in Lane County, I dealt with that. I was the DA at the time. And that lawyer was afraid, and he had every right to be afraid of Mr. Casebeer. Mr. Casebeer was very violent in the past, and he was aggressively prosecuted by our lawyer, and fortunately a snitch at the jail came forward or we might have lost our lawyer. There wasn't much I could do. Witness protection isn't something that we have available in the state of Oregon as we hear about it in the federal system, but I spent taxpayer money to put a security system in his house. They needed something to so they weren't so afraid, and so his wife wasn't afraid. The other reason I wanted to testify about this bill is because, as a longtime prosecutor, I, like Mr. Berry, had a public number. I'm a public official. One night about 3 o'clock in the morning, I received a phone call from somebody who I think was mentally ill. But when they started, I live out in the country, and when they started talking about my barn, I got real worried because I had never said anything to this mentally ill person about my barn. So we figured out who that was, did a little phone work, and some people talked to him, and I didn't have any more problems. But I immediately went to an unlisted phone number. Had this bill been available, I would have taken my home address out of the public records as best I possibly could. The second time, years later, I got a call from a psychiatrist at the Roseburg Veterinary Hospital. He called to tell me that they had a patient there who was threatening my life. And I said, well, how long is he committed for? And the answer was, well, he's here voluntarily and can leave any time. So we got his photograph, spread it around the office, and then the question is, do you show that to your wife? What do you do with your children? Mine were young at the time. And so you have those issues. I can tell you I would have used this bill if it had been passed then and had my address certainly taken out of the public record. This is a good bill. It protects law enforcement officers if they ask to be protected. It requires them to file something. And I would urge you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Questions? Senator.
Thank you, Vice Chair Boquist. I have a sister-in-law who's a federal prosecutor, not in this state, in a large urban area, and I'm sort of frequently concerned about her safety and the safety of my brother and my nephews. So I'm wondering how this bill, whether this covers the people who work in the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Oregon, and what provisions are made for them for the same type of protection that you're asking for our local prosecutors.
It does not specifically cover federal prosecutors. If you note in the bill, it delineates exactly who is covered. Our intent originally, obviously, was for the folks that we deal with. We added the AAGs because they also do criminal prosecutions at the state level, and Senator Brzezinski has offered the amendment to add city prosecutors who are doing criminal prosecutions. But no, we didn't specifically ask for AUSAs to be included. I would note that this is the second time we've approached this topic with the legislature, and that Karen Emmergut, who is the U.S. attorney, I think was aware of it the first time, and I'm getting a little hazy here, but I don't recall her specifically asking that her attorneys be included. And since this is the second run, my guess is that she would at least have been aware of it. It's probably a good idea.
Thank you.
Sir, what's that question?
Story and a question. couple of years ago, I was up in Salem, and my wife called, and she said that somebody that lived about 5 miles away, who has quite a history with the district attorney, had called and was pretty upset and indicating right that he knew right where we lived and so forth, and that he might drop by. He knew that I was out of town. We do have arms in the house. My wife knows how to use them. She called the district attorney, and his response was, well, if he comes to the door and you have to use the gun, make sure he falls inside the house. Do you think that the legislators should have their names redacted from the, and addresses redacted from the public record?
Vice Chair Boquist, Senator Whitsitt is looking at me, so I'll answer that. I'll answer that question.
You're going to be safe because I'm going to ask Mr. Barry the same question in a minute.
If you request it, you have to. The deputy DAs and the DAs have to request it here. Yes, the answer to that is yes. For your safety, this world is not as safe as it used to be. Do I like this? No, I don't like this. I thought my phone number should be public, but we're at risk. And if you're at risk and you request it, then you should be able to do that.
Thank you.
Question?
Gentlemen, I have a couple of questions, and I guess I have no problem with the concept of the bill whatsoever. Fully support. We should protect the deputy district attorneys. We should support the police officers, so on and so forth like that. The two challenges I have with the bill are, first, the elected officials. That's the first issue. And the second issue is how we implement it, to make sure we implement it in a manner that we can identify the documents. I too have a little bit of a story. I have two of them, and two district attorneys from my district are in here, and both of their offices have been involved in this. I recall having several death threats as a state representative, in which they called up and they were going to chop my wife and children up. They told my wife this. They were going to chop my wife and children up and feed them to the pigs. And then the second one is very recently, in the last campaign, in which they were going to fly over my house and shoot me and my family. I live in Polk County, for the record, and the threat came from Yamhill County, and the sheriffs and the district attorneys, in concert with the Attorney General's office, came back and said it's political free speech. So I don't know how we elected officials and the elected officials that are listed in here are going to disconnect that. And I'd like comment on the elected officials. But again, I'm supportive of figuring out how to make this thing work. But when we're asking elected district attorneys and the attorney general to be exempted, and those same people told people sitting at this dais it's political free speech and you can't be protected.
Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, let me see if I can address some of the points that you raise. First, we have said all along, because some of the comments that you may hear from the clerks or the assessors, if they're testifying behind us, is that, you know, who would be next, for example, to be added to this type of non-disclosure. And our point has been, if you can make the case that you should be exempted from disclosure, then I think you ought to be added for this type of protection. My intent, Senator Boquist, is to not apply for confidentiality of my records as an elected official. That's different than my deputy district attorneys, who day in and day out are dealing with these folks being underpaid for what they do and taking on these individuals who are potentially very dangerous. The problem with threats, and I don't recall the specifics of your case, the problem that come with threats deal not just with free speech. The law as it is today in Oregon is that typically those threats have to fall on a, if they're delivered in a particular way, they can be a crime. More often though, we look at the crime of menacing, which has as an element imminency. We have to be able to prove that this danger to you is about to occur. And oftentimes when we have people call our office and say so-and-so is threatening me, we can't get there because we can't prove that imminency. And that's often the case that we have. But more importantly, I am a firm believer in open public records. This is not about hiding public records. This is about the safety of the men and women in our communities that we expect to keep the rest of us safe and who are the targets. When all these cases are said and done, they become the target of the anger of these individuals they prosecute.
Second question,
how are we going to deconflict this? And again, I'm supportive of the concept. I don't have a problem with that. How are we going to deconflict the records request from the district attorneys and the attorney generals with the state elections laws, in which we're required to put our phone numbers in there, and with the ethics filings that we're required to do presently quarterly and hopefully every 6 months or every year, because both of those documents, and those have been to court over this same issue already.
Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, first, my hope is that the changes to reporting requirements which happened last session will be modified this session because they've gotten a little ridiculous. Well, I'm not suggesting that we can protect all of the records that are out there. There are maybe other laws which would require disclosure. What I am suggesting, though, is that those that are the easiest to access are the ones in the courthouse, in a terminal right down the hall from my office, being kept by the good people who do the clerk's work and the good people who do the assessor's work, that we protect my folks from having their own colleagues in the building exposing them to danger unwittingly, but exposing them to danger by giving out this information. So I'm not suggesting that there may not, a very determined person could not find me. I'm just suggesting that the vast majority of these easily accessed public records, we ought to be able to just have a little flag come up in the computer that says not to be released.
I have one last question. Would it be reasonable to say that police officers, and interesting enough, there's not a single public safety person signed up for this, and two-thirds of this protects them. Would it be an option to say that the people covered, the individuals who would be covered by this bill, could provide a list or could identify the places so that say clerks or assessors or other people say know exactly what we're looking for? I mean, be more definitive since they're involved in research and so on and so forth all the time.
Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, respectfully, I don't believe so. I can't tell you that I know every document that is in the clerk's office that has my personal information on it. I don't know every document in the assessor's office, for example, that has my personal information on it. If I did, then I'd say fine. That's a good suggestion, but I don't. I will tell you that as I have researched this in 2007, now again this time, much of this is very simply done. I've talked with our IT people, and it is merely a software fix that when an inquiry is made which identifies my address or identifies my name, for example, that it will not disclose it. The system will tell, will not allow that information to be disclosed. So I think having it as a gross inquiry, no matter what it goes to, is probably an easier data fix than to try and identify each and every document.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
James Morales, Jan Coleman, and Tom, are you here? Tom Gallagher. Whomever wants to lead off. And for the record, it's you're not all on the same panel. I do understand that. I'm just trying to get three seats filled and move on.
Sure. Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, James Morales, Benton County Clerk, on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Clerks. House Bill 2339, once again, county clerks in general are, as Senator Boquist has shared, in favor of the concept. And what we tried to do is help the attorney generals and AGs to come up with an answer to the problem that they were experiencing, or a solution. And we did come up with -2 amendments to House Bill 2339 on the House side. There it goes. And those -2 amendments were to be specific to the county clerk deed, mortgage, and lien records. As there is already some language that addresses the public safety officers in the assessment records, seems what I'm hearing here, and what I think we just heard, was that the main concern is the assessment and the county clerk records. The bill as written is very broad in its scope and general, in that it says any public body, which county clerk's not a public body, but we are part of a public body, so the request would have to go to the county, as would any request to get to the Secretary of State's records, which are the election records that were just mentioned here, would have to go to the public body for the state, which I believe would probably be the legislature. So the scope and the broadness of the current language in the bill for the AG and the Attorney Generals and their deputies is just really broad. And what we would like to see now, we're opposed to the language as it stands. We would like to see it narrowed to address the actual records that are the main concern of the parties involved. Include the public safety officers is fine. I mean, why can't we just go in and plug public safety officers, assistant attorney generals, all in that previous section where they address the assessment records, and also add the county clerk records? But what we feel that it wouldn't be as difficult, we don't believe,
to identify the actual records that are in question. So if we're talking about instruments for the house that you're currently
in, the record, most individuals hold on to their deed and mortgage records, or easily have access because they know what bank they went through, what title company. As the bill is written, with the exception, we'd have to maintain two separate systems, that being a system that would be confidential and exempted, and a second process or system that would allow access to financial institutions and title companies. Maintaining two processes, one confidential, one not confidential, is an expensive venture. Sure, electronically dealing with some of these records would be very doable. However, when we have to deal with microfilm, we start running into significant costs, and we are required to microfilm our public records because our public records are permanent records, and that is the only acceptable medium at the time to be able to hold something permanently if you don't have the original, and we return the original to the recording parties in this case. So we think there are answers, there are alternatives, which we've identified in our testimony as well, if the bill does not go through, things that they can do right now to protect themselves. But as written, it's just so broad that there's just no way that this will work. We need some clarity. We're willing to work and come up with that clarity. We tried to do so on the House side. We were met with opposition. We were continuing to say we want to make this a good bill. We know that the Senate Judiciary Committee would also like to see this to be a good bill that would go out of this committee. Thank you.
All right, who's next?
Senator Provansky, members of the committee, I'm Jan Coleman. I'm with the Oregon Association of County Clerks. Just to augment what James has said, we'd like to work through some impacts and questions and concerns that we have for this bill. We submitted an amendment. Actually, our amendment at this point we think would need some work itself, because as we keep researching this, we find more and more questions that we need answered. The scope is very broad on this. And as we have observed, probably more and more people are going to come to the forefront to ask to have records exempted. So basically, we need procedures, we need direction here. Our first concern is the impacts of this implementation. Once the first record request is received for confidentiality, it's basically in each county going to close the record, because at that point we're going to have to research a number of databases. Basically, we have at least 5 databases in the counties, all of which operate on different systems, different software, so it's not as easy as Mr. Berry would like you to believe, because all of those have to be researched differently. It's going to take someone to go through those. Not everything is on, actually, in every county, a database that's on the computer, so some of that is going to have to be researched through books and so forth. actually the public is going to pay more then too, because once we close the record, any of the records that the public comes in to research, then they're going to have an individual do that and make the copies, and they're going to have to pay for the staff time that many times they don't have to now because they can research their own records. Also, if we have to go through our microfilm, which James has told you, we have to do permanent records. Those are done every time we reach a film. It's about 2,500 images. So those are an ongoing thing that we do. We've researched the cost to redact and then put out a corrected copy of a film. It's about $500 per film or per request. Our questions and concerns that we just compiled that we've been working through, and there'll be more and more that come to the forefront. James said, who's going to receive this request? Does it go to the public governing body? At this point, we're not sure. It could be state, county, whoever. And what happens when a requester moves out of the county or the jurisdiction? At that point, we think, we should be able to reactivate that record and so forth. But there's nothing in there in the bill that addresses that sort of thing at this point. For an out-of-county or out-of-state title company or financial institution, how are we to really know that those are legitimate? What are we going to use to identify that? And frankly, what is a financial institution? How's that going to be defined, and what documents do they provide to us to tell us that they really are who they say they are? And also, for the people that work for them, what are they going to present to us to identify themselves? How do we know that when they're accessing that, they're doing it just for business purposes? Do we now require all of our requests in writing? A lot of our requests now come by email, they come by telephone, they come in the mail. How are we going to handle those, especially for, again, the out-of-state financial institutions? And is there a liability to the county for someone who maybe is working for one of these institutions that may not be as honest as we'd like them to be and may use this information for other means? And do title companies and financial institutions have to maintain some confidentiality type on their end, because they use passwords, et cetera, to access our information? How are we going to handle that? And another thing is we have intermediary companies who now buy the images and so forth for our land records and on a daily basis, many of which they buy them and deal with the title company themselves and resell them. What are those people? How are they going to be impacted? We identify with this problem. We're not discounting it. We had a fellow county clerk in California, some freemen who had approached her to have their federal liens removed from her record, and she would not do that. They followed her home and proceeded to beat her up. So we know, this happens regardless of the public record. But if we're going to do this to the public record, if we're going to close what your predecessors have tried to make open, then we need some direction.
All right, thank you. And Tom, you've already testified or not?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Tom Gallagher, representing our newspaper publishers. Three quick comments. This bill is basically a repeat of what's already in the statute, which came last session. We supported the public safety exemption last session. It meets our concept of a threshold, a criteria of a threshold for protection, and we support the Dash A amendments as they're printed. Objections are to the Dash 3 amendments that I saw this morning, or actually yesterday morning. I have had no communication with city attorneys, have no understanding of why city attorneys would meet our level of threshold as to why they need the same level of protection as a public safety officer. The last thing I'll add here is we're beginning to develop a new concept in public records, which is, I think, valuable, but I have no idea where it's going to go. And that's the concept of access for special groups. And we've always sort of had that for law enforcement. Records are closed except for law enforcement procedures and banking institutions, Department of Revenue, things like that. Those make sense. Now we're starting to talk about financial institutions and other people that use public records for very good business purposes for the general public. Let me just add here, they also represent the land surveyors. And the land surveyors have a concern about this because they use the same property and assessment records for they have a survey done on the property. They can do that to the public. I've convinced them that these are very narrow exemptions from this, but I would agree that the people who are having their information redacted and then want to go and have, like a land survey, are going to pay more money for the survey because the research on it is going to be more difficult for the surveyor to do. That's their choice, and I have no objection to that. So, again, we support the bill. We think the threshold of public safety officers is a good threshold, and it's the -3 amendments, which I have heard no information to date and have no information on as to why that should reach a level of an exemption. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Senator Boquist?
I have one question of the clerks. In, I think, all but one of the counties I represent, and probably the vast majority of the eastern Oregon counties in which we do occasional business with, I can go into the county clerk's office and actually sit down and go through the microfiche myself and look for the documents that I'd be looking for, like land deeds, so on and so forth like that. If this law passes, what happens? It looks to me like I could no longer go in there and look at those myself. Is that correct?
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Chair Brzezinski. I believe that there will be instances in counties that where the record will need to be closed until those records that, especially if they're not identified as we had requested in our proposed amendment, because we're going to be spending a lot of time researching these records, trying to find exactly which records contain the information on these individuals. As soon as we receive the first request, we're going to have to close those the access off until we can deal with those records.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask Mr. Morales and Ms. Coleman, in the fiscal analysis that we have, it says that the Oregon Association of County Clerks estimates that the statewide impact would be approximately $1.3 million. And I know, Ms. Coleman, you talked about the $500 per request amount. On what is that based? I mean, I didn't do the math, but this is a bill that is, if requested. And so did you count the number of people you anticipated might request, or did you use all of the possible requesters? How did you arrive at that number? Thank you.
Senator Bonamici, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. The initial $1.2 million estimate was based on all of the program changes that would be needed, running dual systems, the staff time that it's going to take for the research. We figured probably about at least a staff member per county if we're going to be conducting all the research for anybody coming into our offices. Currently, we have our systems available for the public to come in and access the records. So that came out to about, I think it was a clerk per county that's just dedicated to assisting people with research requests. And so that came out to the larger. The $500, it's actually per record cost, was an estimate that we received when we contacted some of our vendors, is what it would take to get the microfilm redactions done. And it was dealing with the individual records, not the overall cost. So that is a per record cost.
Can I ask a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
But when you figured this amount, when you looked at the cost, how many people were you expecting would request? I mean, what was your assumption? Because this is if the person requests. So did you assume that everyone who was eligible to request would request, or did you take a, maybe half of them would request? Or I'm just trying to figure out what you anticipated would be the number of people
requesting.
Yeah,
we tried to go with, I'm sorry about that, Senator Bonamici, Chair Brzezinski. Our initial request, we tried to go with the worst case scenario, where we're saying, if this is the worst case scenario, where every county receives a request from their district attorneys or attorney generals living in, deputy DAs and such, living in their jurisdiction, that was the worst case scenario for the larger estimate. The per record of $500 is just dealing on an individual basis with the redaction. That's the cost for the one-time redaction.
Of the film. Thank you.
Correct. Any other questions?
Senator Quest.
Yeah, comment regarding that and kind of a follow-up to Senator Bonamici. In the counties that I represent, you can go into the county clerk's office, and because they don't have the staff time, you walk in and you're looking for a document, and they have a ledger book, and you look through the ledger book, and then you go down to the microfiche, and if you could put your glasses on and find the little teeny number and find the microfiche file, and you plug it into the machine, and you start looking for the documents that you're looking for. I probably go to a county clerk's office a dozen times a year. There's generally two or three people there doing exactly the same thing I'm doing. And I think the issue comes, it doesn't matter whether there's one person who wanted it redacted or 50 who wanted it redacted. The public is walking in and looking at all those machines. So until that specific document was redacted out of there, the only way to protect it in the district attorney's area is to close the records. So to me, I mean, the fiscal's kind of all over the place. It could be one county nothing or another county a lot. I mean, obviously in Multnomah County, where I would guess if you went to the clerk's office, there's a dozen people searching the records at one given time. So who knows what it's going to be.
Mr. Chair, I would really like a sense of, and it may be hard to do this, but how many people are actually going to be requested?
Let me go ahead and go forward on a couple of things in response. Senator Bonamici, I think that's one of those things that's an unknown. All you can do is count up how many potential people do you have and how many are going to actually do it and actually carry forward. I think there's a couple of things. First, on the A3s, Tom, there was a mistake made on there. It says city attorney. It's supposed to say city prosecutor is what it's supposed to have said. So that's going to be changed. And also that I would assume you'd have no problem for federal or U.S. Prosecutors.
Protection of public safety and law enforcement officials is fine.
Right, and so I apologize that it was said as broad as it did, because I agree with you that would take in individuals doing non-public safety work in the sense of just civil work. The other part, I guess, is for the clerks, and this is an attempt to, let's say, narrow what would need to be dealt with. Would it be beneficial for the person who's coming in and requesting to actually specifically tell you what documents they are wanting to have excluded, instead of having them say, my name is this, I work here, so I want all my records, but instead saying, I have a mortgage with so-and-so, or these type of papers? Because I would assume, even on the microfiche and stuff, if you had those captured in that sense, you could pull that one microfiche out. So if someone wanted to look at that one microfiche, then you would be able to go to your closed area and not completely close everything. And then you could take the steps on those documents that have been specifically requested.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, that's absolutely correct. And that is part of what the Dash 2 amendments that we introduced on the House side that we had asked for, that they just identify the instruments that they would like us to redact that information from, and we'd be happy to do that. The other thing that we introduced on the House side was to include public safety officers, because right now, the way it's written, it's specific to only district attorneys, and the public safety officers can only do so on the assessment records.
Right.
And the processes for the public safety officers and the assessment records is what we would like to see, where they have a clear process for when it's over, you know, to terminate the request. There's a process for that. There's all the steps are there.
All right. I think this is what I'd like to do, Senator Quest.
I just want to, for the record, because you had stepped out for another committee hearing, a couple of things that I'd raised. The deconfliction fully agree with what the direction you're suggesting, Mr. Chair. In all honesty, the District Attorney's Association, I asked that question, and they were opposed to providing specifics. So I want to get that on the record so you knew that was on the record. The other things that I was wondering about is how we're going to deconflict with state election laws, where we all have to file, the district attorneys and the AG have to file ethics reports that have all that information, how we'll deconflict with that. And the only other thing that I didn't see in here, and I'm not sure why it wasn't in there, the public safety officers all have a non-liability or may not result in liability clause in their portion of this, but there's no such non-liability clause on the District Attorney's Association side. I don't know why that was not there or what the intent was.
Okay. This is what I'm contemplating at this point. I think we need to have some more work done on this, so I'm going to ask counsel to work with the interested parties to see if we can, let's say, come to some resolutions to some of the open issues that we have. And I'm also going to ask Senator Boquist to check in with counsel as to his issues, and then at some point, if necessary, either Senator Boquist or myself or both can help facilitate and review stuff as we are moving through this process. Due to the time frame that we're in, we have to have the work completed by May 28th, and so we have basically a week and a half, 2 weeks on the outside to get this done. So with that, was there any other comments that we need to make on this particular bill?
Mr. Chair, I think it would be helpful to include a definition of financial institution and include agents for the financial institution or title companies.
All right, so council will work with the interested parties, and we'll see if we can get this in a better situation for moving forward. All right, with that, and let me just make sure, was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2339? Sorry, Paul. You're on the list, too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Snyder representing Association of Oregon Counties, and all my issues have been covered, Mr. Chair. For the record, we're neutral on the bill, and we appreciate the issues that have been raised by the folks who have to deal with these records issues, and we certainly appreciate the interests of the prosecutors who are also our employees.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe, representing the Oregon Land Title Association, and the only reason I came up was to identify myself to counsel. We obviously are interested in this bill. I'll hold any additional comments until later discussion.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2339, and we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which is House Bill 2262A.
House Bill 2262A requires any plea petition involving a dismissal of criminal charges to include provisions detailing how the court is to address the dismissed counts if a plea is subsequently withdrawn or judgment of conviction is reversed or set aside. There's no revenue impact and minimal expenditure, no statement issued.
All right, Ronell.
Good morning. For the record, Ronell Schenkel with the Attorney General's Office here today in support of House Bill 2262. You have the lobbyists coming in front of you instead of the attorney because, in essence, the way this bill started out being highly technical and legal has changed significantly, and now it's really much more of a common understanding bill, as I like to refer to it. You have the written testimony with the details, but in essence, what we have done is just attempted to make it clear in the statute for all of the counties that in the plea negotiations and the pleadings and the agreements, you need to put into those clarification of what the intent is should charges be dismissed and then those negotiations fall through or be changed by the court so everyone has an understanding of what the agreement was. That's in essence all this does is ask people to put that into place so there is a clear understanding. It does not determine what that resolution will be on any particular case. We do have in the audience, if you have questions, Senior Assistant Attorney General Michael Slauson, who has expertise on this.
All right, any questions? Any desire to have anyone else come up to answer questions?
Work session.
All right, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2262A. Open a work session on House Bill 2262A.
Chair, move HB 2262A to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2262A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And
sure, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist?
Yeah.
Will carry, be our carrier. And we'll close the work session on 2262A. And that we'll open up House Bill, public hearing on House Bill 3051A.
House Bill 3051A addresses a gap in the implied consent law by adding evidentiary provisions to the statute that would make the admissibility of urine testing consistent with the statutes addressing blood and breath testing. This one had no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, with no statement issued.
All right. We have a number of people who would like to testify. And let's see. Appears at this point I'll bring up Brad Berry, Doug Harkerode, and let's see. Why don't you two come up, and then I've got another panel of neutrals.
Sure. Could you invite up Dina Ryerson?
Dina, we'll come on up. And she was in the neutral, but we will put her on board with y'all. And while y'all are getting set, it looks like Gail Meyer was wanting to give testimony today in opposition, but she had to leave, I guess, for another hearing or meeting. So it's just noted that she did sign up on the registry.
Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, my name is Brad Berry. I'm the Amhill County District Attorney, and I chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. This is a bill that we strongly support. It is designed as always want to say it wrong, Tripathi, fix on a case that ruled against, well, actually Ms. Ryerson is kind of the technical expert on this, and with the chair's permission, I'd like to just kind of hand it over to her to explain what it does and what it's fixing.
Good morning, Senator Prusansky and members of the committee. My name is Dina Ryerson, and I'm with the Department of Justice. A couple months ago, a case, State versus Tripathi, came out, and in effect, what it discussed was urine test results coming into evidence. Under implied consent law, someone who gets their driver's license deems to give consent to blood, breath, and urine tests when an officer believes that the person's under the influence, driving under the influence. And under the statute, under the implied consent statute for blood and breath, there's provisions in the statute that discuss if in the case of blood, if done in a licensed or accredited lab, it comes into evidence. And for breath, you know, if it's done pursuant to policy set up by the Oregon State Police Crime Lab, it comes into evidence. Under the urine statute, the statute currently says if it's done in a licensed or accredited lab, but didn't add that last part, is admissible in evidence. And so what this bill is doing is making the three of them consistent to say that the state doesn't have to lay a scientific foundation every time we want to get a urinalysis record into evidence, and therefore making a potentially inconsistent rulings on how our crime lab does urinalysis testing. And so that's the purpose of the statute, is to make blood, breath, and urine consistent with regards to evidentiary records coming in trial.
Thank you.
My name's Doug Harkerode, the retired district attorney from Lane County, and I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. We're strongly in support of this bill. It's a little more than housekeeping, but not a lot more. It just says the science is good in accredited labs for testing, and we shouldn't have to prove every time we walk into the courtroom on a routine-type testing that it meets all the scientific requirements. And so we ought to make this consistent with blood and breath, and put it into the statute that it comes in and is admissible. And just a note, I tour the crime lab in Lane County three times a year with students where I teach at the University of Oregon. And they're set up to run these tests. They run them
pretty close to daily. It's a routine thing they do. This is not like an unusual scientific thing that needs to be dealt with individually in court because it's some esoteric test. That's all I have. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you explain the language on the page 2 where it says a chemical analysis of a person's urine is valid under this subsection if analysis is performed in an accredited or licensed toxicology laboratory? And I just want to clarify that I understand that you don't want to have to establish that the lab was official and that meets all the requirements of the laboratory, but does this limit the defendant's ability to say, for example, the test was done incorrectly or maybe it wasn't my urine or it was misread or something like that? Does it limit that, or does it just deal with the admissibility of it and establishing that the laboratory was legitimate?
Senator Bonamici, what this has just to do with the foundational, just getting the actual test into evidence to say that the crime lab's procedures and protocols, you know, are followed and are good practice. If a defendant then wants to come in and say, we don't agree with, you know, this isn't my urine, or we don't agree with, you know, this part of the testing, or they can attack the actual, they can attack it. They just can't say it doesn't come into evidence because the crime lab doesn't follow the proper procedures with regards to their testing. And I know Randy Wampler's here and is planning on testifying for the crime lab as to what their procedures are. But this just has to do with the base scientific foundation, just like blood and just like breath.
Right. And Mr. Chair, I don't have any problem with that. It's just the way that it's worded. The use of the word valid and the fact that it talks about a chemical analysis is valid. I was just concerned, so I wanted to clarify the record. So thank you.
Chair Przanski, if I might, and Senator Bonamici, I just point out that your question goes to the ability to attack it. It's the same way with a breath test. The breath test is deemed to come in, but then any defendant could attack that the officer didn't administer it correctly or that the machine wasn't working correctly at the time. It's actually the same thing. This is just a basis for admissibility.
Thank you. Just for the clarification.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. And Randy Wampler, you're signed up on a... looks like you got testimony. Come on up.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Randy Wampler. I'm the Director of the Forensic Services Division for the Oregon State Police. And I'm just here to talk a little bit about 3051. The crime laboratories, while there are 6 crime laboratories, we only perform toxicology for DUII in 2 of the crime labs. That's in Springfield and Portland. So therefore, we have a court liability that can cover a large area of the state. In 2008, we did over 2,100 requests for service for urine toxicology for DUII type of cases. And also in 2008, we testified in 96 instances for these types of analysis. Just to kind of give you a relative number of how many times we do this. Most of our requests result in stipulation or settlement before trial, but Tripathi gives us a potential of having to lay a foundation many more times than what we have or have required us to have many more hearings than what we currently see now. Of course, those times, those hearings are in prior to the actual trial, which would then require us to have additional court liability. The technology and methodology that we use for toxicology is a standard technology and methodology that you will see in virtually all chemistry and toxicology laboratories. And we also are accredited. We've been accredited since 2005, and since 2006 we've actually been accredited under international standards ISO 17025, which are the highest level of accreditation standards for chemical testing laboratories. I'll take any questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for coming forward and giving us the testimony. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 3051? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3051.
And we're going to hold off until Senator Boquist gets back. And he is back.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to move into a work session on House Bill 3051.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3051 to the A, to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 3051A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I support the bill. I just really appreciated the clarification because I don't think it's worded. It's as clearly as it could be. So with the clarification, I will support the bill.
All right, thank you. And Senator Dingfelder?
I have some very similar concerns, and thanks to Senator Bonamici for asking that question. While you were out, Mr. Chair, I just will tell you that we discussed the bill that was, this was a gut and stuff. We actually discussed the original bill and just wanted to let you know I was disappointed that the original bill ended up being a gut and stuff and not just an addition. Because I did support the original bill as well. Anyway.
Well, I was here.
Ignition interlocks.
Do you hear for that discussion? We talked about ignition interlocks.
No,
we're
going to
ignition interlocks.
Right. We're going to have some discussions on. I think there's the other one, too.
Since you missed discussion, I just wanted to hang them all and make them pay for it.
Okay. All right. So at this point, we have a motion before us. It sounds like there's no objection to the motion to move House Bill 3051A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And please show Senator Wissett excused. And that's ordered. And Chair will carry this bill. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 3051. And we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2738A.
Yeah.
House Bill 2738A provides that disabled or abandoned vehicles taken into custody by a public body will be sold or disposed of by the person engaged to tow the vehicle. Clarifies which statutes are modified by the original bill. No revenue impact, minimal fiscal, with no statement issued.
All right, thank you. And whoever wants to get started?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tammy Wood. I'm a captain with the Linn County Sheriff's Office, also president of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association Civil Command Council, and we're asking for your support on this bill. This bill deals with the statutes regarding towing of vehicles that are abandoned on the side of a road or are parked as a hazard. And I'm going to explain a little bit how the process goes so you understand why we're asking for this bill. When a vehicle is towed by a law enforcement officer, we then have to send out letters to the people who own the vehicle, let them know that it's been towed. We then have to either go out ourselves and appraise the vehicle or cause it to be appraised. And then we have to, depending on the appraisal amount, use one of four methods to dispose of the vehicle. When we're done with the disposal of the vehicle, we complete a bill of sale. It goes to the purchaser or to the tow company. And then we notify DMV how that we dispose of the vehicle. However, in the end, our bill of sale, DMV will only give the purchaser a branded title. The statutes also require that the person who appraises the vehicle be licensed to appraise. And in the case of my office, I have 6 licensed appraisers, and it's a cost for our office to do that. At the same time that law enforcement is utilizing that process to dispose of the vehicle, the statutes also allow the tow companies to follow the possessory chattel lien statutes to dispose of a vehicle. So as we're heading off doing our thing, they are doing much the same, only under Chapter 87. They send notices to the owners. They appraise the vehicle, and depending on the appraisal amount, they sell the vehicle, and they end up with a bill of sale. So in the end, it's the same time frames, it's 2 different entities doing the work, and there's 2 different bills of sale, one that results in a branded title, one that results in a clean title. And so our work goes in the garbage because the clean title is worth more than the branded title. What this bill does is it allows us to get out of the appraisal and sale of the vehicle and just allows the tow companies to follow the statutes under Chapter 87. Longer incur the cost of having to advertise some of these vehicles. For instance, if the vehicle is over $1,000, the law enforcement agency has to publish the notice in the newspaper, and that results in a cost for us. It also leaves in place the requirement that we must notify the owner of the vehicle once it's been towed. It just removes law enforcement out of the appraisal and the sale of the vehicle and resulting the branded title. And allows them to foreclose under Chapter 87. It also allows it to leaves in place one requirement is that vehicles appraised under $500 would still be sold only to a dismantler, so we're not putting junk vehicles back out on the road. Thank you.
Chair Perzanski and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Wallace, and I'm the Chief Civil Deputy at the Marion County Sheriff's Office here in Salem. I'm here today on behalf of my sheriff and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association in support of this bill, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak before you. Written testimony has been submitted to be a part of the official record, and also from one of my colleagues from Washington County Sheriff's Office that wasn't able to be here today. I'm going to repeat just a little bit of what Captain Wood said and hopefully expand a little bit and hopefully leave with a recommendation that this bill goes to the floor with a due pass. As my colleague was saying, this bill provides for a vehicle that is towed as abandoned or as a hazardous vehicle to be disposed of by the person that tows or who engages in towing of the vehicle. One of the questions that was brought up on the House side was, are tow companies then going to just go and start towing vehicles on the side of the road? This only pertains to vehicles that are tagged as abandoned by law enforcement. So I just wanted to clarify that if that question popped up in your mind. As my colleague said, there is a duplication of efforts in that both a tow company and a law enforcement agency a lot of times simultaneously appraise the vehicle and go through the lien process. These vehicles in most circumstances are appraised fairly low because the type of vehicles that are usually left as abandoned or hazard on the side of the road are pretty much mechanically or structurally unsound. In those cases, the vehicle is either dismantled or it's eventually signed over to the tow company, depending on the appraisal amount. And like my colleague was saying, the tow company basically throws away our certificate or bill of sale because they don't get a clean title. And so I hate to say it, but what we're kind of doing is pointless. And it costs my county the tune of $10,000 a year to have an appraiser. And that's as a temporary employee. That doesn't include benefits or anything like that. This bill doesn't change the due process requirement for us to notify a registered owner that their vehicle was towed, or a lien holder, a bank, whatnot. So it keeps that intact. And the other part of the bill that this changes is before Oregon State Police and Oregon Department of Transportation could turn their authority over for noticing the vehicle and performing the appraisal, of course they would do that to the sheriff. They would basically send all their paperwork over if they towed on the interstate or a highway, and we would have to go appraise Oregon State Police towed vehicle. And of course, that would also help us out too, so we can get to some more crucial things out there as far as public safety. This bill we've worked really hard with the Oregon Towers Association. There was a lot of questions that were asked on the House side that we clarified, and I think we're at a point now where it's a really good bill. I know that there was a note that was sent over by Chair Barker. There was some concern from one particular representative that these statutes are confusing and they're poorly written, and I would agree with that. But I don't know if we have enough time this session to tackle that, but we would certainly be open to that next session. But I really hope that you send this to the floor with a due pass, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Is there anyone else who want to give testimony on House Bill 2738A? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2738A.
Mr. Chairman, move HB 2738A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2738A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Question. Yes. So do we really still use the word chattel?
Yes, absolutely.
It seems like a totally archaic term to me, but anyway, as a non-attorney.
Yeah, wait until you go to law school.
Yeah.
All right.
I'll be waiting a long time for that one. Yeah.
Any other questions?
I just wonder why it took so long to fix this.
No.
All righty. If there's not, then any objection to the motion? So order.
Senator Dean Felder
will carry the chattel bill. And we'll close that. And Senator Wissett was excused on that vote as well. So that takes care of what we had, with the exception of what we took some testimony on. And I want to go ahead and reopen, at this point, I guess, open a work session on House Bill 2870. And I have been informed on my way back into the to our committee hearing that there was some discussion by the committee during the public hearing portion as to one of the sections being taken out as it pertained to what was originally on the House side, requiring certain individuals to use ignition interlock devices. So let me give you a little perspective. There was some discussion about that, and it was determined, and the proponents of the bill had agreed and actually had recognized that there was going to be a potential significant cost for that to actually occur. And the concern that they have, and one that I raised previously in other meetings, was that this was one of those things that would force the bill into Ways and Means because of the impact that DMV would have to have in doing all the monitoring and all of that requirement for interlock ignition. So that's kind of what and why the bill had that provision stripped out. And so we'll discuss.
Nicholas can go first.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a problem sending the Ways and Means, and I don't have a problem establishing a fee and force the offenders to pay DMV. I mean, at the cost of three, you know, we're removing some statutes from 8 to 10 years, the cost of incarceration or the cost of some of the incarcerations across the board for this will pay for itself almost instantly if we start forcing people to use an interlock system. The more people who use that system, as you know, the less we're going to have them drive on the road. I mean, we continue to increase fees and jail time and everything else, and we're in the DUI sector. We're already at the fear level now where these are repeat offenders, and they simply don't care. It doesn't matter whether we, you know, unless we're going to make capital punishment, they don't care. And so if they don't start blowing into the interlock system and we don't start using the interlock system more, we're going to continue to have, you know, more deaths. And I fully understand the deal, and I'm more than willing to, let's find something with the relating clauses and go in there, wear and gut and stuff it, and start the process of talking about getting real results on this sort of thing. Right.
And Senator Dingfelder, before you do, one of the thoughts I had was that this could be something that would be worked in the interim because it's, I mean, there's a lot of components to this. Yes, you can require a car that is registered to the individual to be equipped with that equipment, but that in itself doesn't stop the individual for accessing some other vehicles. So, and then when you look at what the penalty is and stuff like that, I think all of that needs to be factored in to, you know, as we go down this path, what are all the procedures and safeguards that we were going to put in place. And to be frank with you, thinking of the time frame that we have for this session, I would find it very difficult. I mean, if you want to take on a task force and try to hammer something out in the next week, So be it. I'll let you, shop that around. I'm not sure what we've got in the way of bills to be able to use. This is definitely one, but I know the proponents would like this to go forward and have the discussion continue in the future. Senator Dingfelder.
Well, I just was going to say that I share the same concerns as Senator Boquist. I mean, as I think you know, a good friend of mine, it was a cyclist, was hit by and killed by a drunk driver. I think it was his third offense. And, the problem is getting repeat offenders, off the road. And the costs in the long term are going to be a cost savings to the state. So I appreciate, it just seems to me that there's counties already doing it. I don't know why we just can't have it uniform across the state, but that's concern that I have. I would prefer if we could deal with it, if it's possible, this session, if not, the interim.
All right. What I'm going to do at this point, I'm going to close the work session. I would like for this bill, today's Friday, I do not want it to get lost in the shuffle. And so, Shannon, when's the next day in your schedule?
I can come at any time. It's really not a problem.
All right. I'm going to set this over until Wednesday of next week to give us some opportunity, a few days for people to gather and talk and see what, if anything, we may try to address between now and the 28th. All right. So with that, we're going to close the work session with House Bill 2870 being set over until next Wednesday, which would be, I believe it's the 20th.
The 20th.
Okay. And is there anything else that we need to go over? And we got everything squared away. So yeah. Monday. What we're going to go ahead and do is I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2339A. This is the one with the disclosure of information, the county clerks, and we will set that one over until next Friday, a week from today, which will be May 22nd.
All right. I won't be here thinking of that. I'm excused that day.
Okay. I tell you what, let's just put it Thursday the 21st, and that's to allow the full committee to be here, and we'll see if we're ready to do anything with that. And then regarding next week on Monday, I believe we're scheduled to be here at 8:30, so we'll see everyone on Monday at 8:30, and Senate Judiciary is closed for today.